Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you want to download it to your computer or iPod, which is what I like doing. You can listen to shows whenever you have time. So today we have an excellent show as we evaluate last week's Supreme Court decision in the Kwan case, which addressed the privacy rights of employees using company equipment. For those who use cell phones to text sensitive information about your private life, or if you're like some of the recent politicians from South Carolina, this case can cause you to perk up. Cell phones, like personal computers, contain an awful lot of personal information about us, as the police officer in Kwan found out when evaluated, this information can be embarrassing. We were all waiting for the Supreme Court to issue its opinion, and now it has. So what does it mean? And I'm really thrilled today. We've got a great panelist to discuss this with us. Ed McNicholas is a partner at the Washington, D.C. office of Sidley Austin. His practice focuses on clients facing complex information technology, constitutional and privacy issues, and civil and white-collar criminal matters. Ed has significant experience with a wide range of cutting-edge internet and information law matters involving privacy and data protection, online brand protection, e-discovery, electronic surveillance, defamation, information security, cloud computing, trade secrets, social media, locational privacy, e-commerce, and national security. The 2007 Computer World Survey of Best Privacy Advisors recognized him as one of the, quote, top 25 privacy experts in the country. And Ed and Sidley's privacy and data security practice were selected for Chambers USA, America's Leading Lawyers for Business for 2008 and 2009, as well as Chambers Global for 2010. Ed, great to have you on the show. Sounds like this topic was made for you.
Yes, happy to be here.
Well, before I start the show, I always like to ask, how did you get started in electronic discovery?
Well, I've been with Sidley Austin since 1997 and have done some very large class action cases that involved extensive electronic discovery. But I would say my most interesting experience was during a time I spent over in the White House counsel's office under President Clinton, and I did electronic discovery with respect to the independent counsel investigations by independent counsel Starr and some other independent counsels, as well as congressional committees, back when there was a dispute over an intern we all know. And so that was an interesting e-discovery experience.
I'm sure. Well, now let's and that was an interesting answer. I got to tell you, of all the panelists we've had, maybe 130 or so at this point, most people just sort of fell into it and played with computers. So unique answer. Now let's talk about Kwan. Can you first provide an overview of the case?
Okay. Well, let me just frame it up for you. First, the principal issue in Kwan was whether a governmental employee has a reasonable expectation of privacy in text messages sent through a government-issued paging system, despite there being a written policy that such messages were subject to monitoring without notice. Now, the interesting thing in Kwan's case is that a supervisor had orally assured the employees that their messages would not be reviewed if they paid for them. Nevertheless, the employer, which was a SWAT team, conducted a limited review of a couple months of messages, and they did this review to figure out whether the police department, was paying for enough and whether they were drawing the line between personal use and official use appropriately. Now, during the review, Kwan's supervisor discovered that Kwan was sending a fairly large number of text messages that were personal and sometimes even sexually explicit. He apparently was quite friendly with some of his coworkers. And they referred the matter to Internal Affairs. Internal Affairs then went through and cut out all of the messages that Kwan had sent when he was off duty and then looked at the ones that he sent while he was on duty. And based upon this review, they determined that he should be disciplined for his texting habits. The record is silent as to exactly what discipline happened. Now, the district court ruled in favor of the city of Ontario, California, and that was not an overly interesting ruling. But then the Ninth Circuit reversed, and it held that the examination of his text messages was unreasonable as a matter of law and violated the Fourth Amendment. And it was that decision in the Ninth Circuit that raised fears that employers' written policies would not be respective, as conclusively precluding employees from having an expectation of privacy in electronic devices. Now, the Supreme Court did not find this case all that divisive. Justice Kennedy wrote an opinion for 8 members of the court. There were 2 separate concurrences, but everyone came to the same result here. And the Supreme Court declined to embrace some broad view of the issue presented, or to attempt to announce some new rule for emerging technologies. It said that a broad holding concerning employee privacy expectation vis-a-vis employer-provided technological equipment might have implications for future cases that cannot be predicted. It is therefore preferable to dispose of the case on narrow ground. And that's exactly what they did. They essentially said that the search conducted in this case was reasonable, and they did not get to the issue of whether the employee had an expectation of privacy or whether other searches would also be reasonable. So it was a very narrow ruling in some ways.
Well, we were all waiting for this decision to come down. I remember doing a top 10 program with Ron Hedges at the beginning of the year, and we talked about Quan. I think I've done a couple of other podcasts where we talked about Quan and privacy. Do you think a lot of people were disappointed in the e-discovery field and what they read?
I think there is some disappointment, but I think that the expectations for this case were probably set too high. I went to the oral argument in the case, and certainly based on the oral argument, it seemed that although the justices are certainly aware of the broader possible implications of this, that they were going to look at this in a pretty factually specific context. I think some of the expectations got raised by the broad nature of the Ninth Circuit holding and the Court of Appeals, and then the briefing in this case urged the court to move beyond the government-employer context and to address whether employers in general can limit employee expectations of privacy and personal communications. For instance, the Solicitor General urged that the court broadly establish that employers' written policies conclusively establish the relevant expectation of privacy, and they contended that a non-policymaking official, like Quan's supervisor, should have been unable to modify the policy, and that any lax enforcement or contradictory enforcement or comments from a supervisor could not undermine the written policy. And so people put it to the court in a very broad way, which is not uncommon, but it also wasn't uncommon for the Supreme Court to respond in a very narrow way.
Well, what were some of the paths the Supreme Court could have taken to analyze the right to privacy, which might have provided more insight for practitioners? I mean, what are some of the open questions here?
Well, the biggest open question is whether or not there'd be a categorical rule. If we look back, there was a line of cases coming in the telephone context that established the basic expectation of privacy in a phone call. And that established a broad rule that if you're speaking on a phone, the government may not wiretap that unless there's an exception to the Fourth Amendment that's relevant, or there's a court order, which is, of course, one of the exceptions to the Fourth Amendment. And so we have an expectation that our voice communications are generally private. And that was established. And then there was another case, a further case, that said that the call records, the records of who you call and when, have a different level of privacy expectation associated with them. The court could have reached out and said that there was a broad expectation of privacy in text messages, making them somewhat analogous to phone calls. Or the court could say there was no expectation of privacy or reduced expectation of privacy on a constitutional level, which is more similar to emails. Now, emails get a little bit more complicated because then there's a statute that establishes an expectation of privacy. But speaking solely on a constitutional basis, emails and phone calls are quite different. And so if one looked at that as the question presented, whether text messages are more like phone calls or more like emails, the Supreme Court could have announced a broad rule there. But the current Supreme Court is not a court that sees it as part of its role to announce those sorts of rules. They want to issue narrow decisions and just answer the question before them.
You know, it is interesting because if you look around at state court opinions and I know they were looking at the Fourth Amendment in this case, but you know the sanctity of a personal computer, for example, is something that is widely respected by the courts, and you can't just go fishing around someone's personal computer. It would seem to me you can find much more in text messaging than you can almost off of a phone call because of the recording nature of it. It just seems like the technology, you know, is causing more and more, you know, erosion of privacy. The rules aren't necessarily keeping up. I mean, do you have that sort of a gut reaction that there's a battle being fought here?
There is a battle being fought here, and part of the battleground is whether or not employer rights are going to be extended onto the internet space. It started out that it was a very simple thing, that employers had the ability to control their computer systems. They set them up and they operate them. But now that computer systems have become the a very powerful communications technology and are pervasive and ubiquitous, has it moved towards them being essentially like phone calls, and so that people have their personal lives and their work lives intertwined so that there should be an expectation of privacy in workplace computers. A lot of European countries have recognized a much more robust sense of personal privacy in the workplace, and you're seeing some states start to recognize that as well. But the Supreme Court was not willing to go there yet.
Okay. Now, Justice Scalia had a concurring opinion which differed from Justice Kennedy's opinion, even though he agreed with the opinion. You care to comment on that?
Sure. Let me just clarify what the difference is here. So under Justice Kennedy's approach, writing for eight justices, of course, employers have some uncertainty about how the employees' expectation of privacy will be shaped by future changes in technology, or the degree to which society would be prepared to recognize those expectations as reasonable. That's a quote from the opinion. So on his decision, he said, it would seem that devices deemed, quote, essential means or necessary instruments for self-expression or self-identification, unquote, will be accorded some degree of privacy. But that degree of privacy is then tempered by how much these devices cost and the employer policies. Now, in his concurring opinion, Justice Scalia took issue with that approach, and he wrote that any rule that requires evaluating whether a given gadget is a necessary instrument for self-expression or self-identification, unquote, on top of asserting the degree to which the law's treatment of workplace norms has evolved, he said, to put it mildly, is unlikely to yield objective answers. So his basic point was that the rules here should be more clear, and there shouldn't be a consideration of whether a particular gadget is what it means socially and how important it is for self-identification, and then have the employer's policy be a factor in evaluating this. You got the sense that Justice Scalia would have said the employer's policy answers the question. You look at the policy, and the inquiry is done. You don't need to inquire into whether or not that particular gadget has become ubiquitous or is an important part of what people see as their self-expression.
Sort of now trying to wrap up this case, is there anything, about this decision which e-discovery lawyers and employment lawyers can take going forward?
You know, on a practical level, there's actually a fair amount of good guidance here. It's on a very practical level, employers should go back and look at their policies, and they should look at their policy and see if there's significant tension between what their policy is and their practices are. If employers say in their policy that they will monitor everything and employees have zero expectation of privacy, then they should look and see, are we in fact allowing a certain amount of personal usage of the machines? If in fact they're allowing a certain amount of personal usage of machines, they should examine, are we going to continue to allow that, or should we clamp down on that? And if we're going to continue to allow that, should we have to adjust the way we're approaching e-discovery and internal investigations? Should we have some sort of minimization procedures in place? And so that's kind of the, for an e-discovery professional, the practical import of this is that this sort of battle is going to come back. It was not fully resolved here. It will come back. And so a cautious e-discovery expert is going to have a plan for how they're going to document why they're searching, the purpose of the search, and the method used. And they're going to make the method used proportional to the purpose of their search. And then in that, they're going to specify what other folks call minimization procedures, procedures to get rid of data that is likely to be irrelevant and likely to be more personal. So if someone has a file labeled personal, they'll consciously say, we are not going to look at that. And they're going to document the fact that they're not looking at that as a way of respecting privacy.
Go ahead.
And so this is particularly important, though, in states that have all-party consent, because in those states, the rules change and are a bit stronger than the federal rules.
Okay. And then now let's look at the Supreme Court itself and e-discovery. Do we have any insights into what the Supreme Court thinks about electronic discovery or even their technical capability?
Well, it is clear that the Supreme Court is going to restrain itself for some time from deciding whether expectations of privacy are going to be established for each device. Now, the benefit of this approach is that it provides room for other branches of government, mainly, Congress, state houses, to establish expectations of privacy at hand and the privacy norms that govern any given technology. And that's a nice thing about this approach is that it allows, the California legislature to come forward and say people do have an expectation of privacy in their text messages as a matter of state law. And that can be a very, very powerful driver. And the Supreme Court, I think, is quite conscious about respecting its limited role in this process.
That was
And
actually
so I.
a good answer to a question I wasn't asking, but it was a great, it was, you know, it was, I should have asked it. So, so I appreciate the answer. Actually, what I was looking at was sort of the role of educating your fact finder on e-discovery, because, I read some of the excerpts of the case and, there was some dialogue with Justice Roberts asking how a pager works. And the use of technology by the justices might not be that high. So would you have any advice on counsel arguing an e-discovery issue to the Supreme Court,
Well,
given that
I
lack
do
of
think it. Well,
knowledge?
in any case, at the Supreme Court or even a district court, it is very important for the advocates to be straightforward with the court up front and to educate the court about the particular computer systems in place. You want to provide extensive background briefing on these technologies, in part because, particularly if you're at the Supreme Court, the justices will kick the tires and will ask hypotheticals and think about the implications of the technology, to the possible future uses of technology. And so they will want to really get into it. And if you don't provide sufficient information about the technology in the briefing, you can wind up with someone taking an implication of technology and running with it logically in a way that technology will not support. And so, like many things, the technologists and the lawyers need to communicate. And if the lawyers who are arguing the case and trying to be translator, essentially, there, don't do a good job of communicating, you're going to have a problem with the decision.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking before the show about the real challenge a Supreme Court justice has and the breadth of cases that they face. Restate
sure, I mean,
that point that you made? I thought it was an excellent point.
Of course. Well, fair enough. If you look at the Supreme Court's docket, you'll see that they're on the cutting edge of any number of fields. They're on the cutting edge of labor relations, of tax law, of employee benefits, of patents, of copyrights. They're of any number of international trade disputes. They are called in to resolve disputes at the very cutting edge of any number of fields. You have to appreciate that they're not as focused on e-discovery as an e-discovery professional, and to provide enough support so that they can, you know, rapidly get themselves up to speed at the very at the most interesting issues in this area. But that's what they do. That's their job, is to come in and help correct the law in these interesting areas.
Well, I think we've gone through Quan pretty well here, Ed. I really appreciate you giving us your sharing your knowledge on the Fourth Amendment and how the Supreme Court handled this issue. Hopefully, we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year, as there still seems to be a lot more work to be done in this area. I guess that's good for all of us, right?
Indeed, indeed. There's another. They just granted a review of a case involving background checks for NASA employees, and so this issue will be back before the Supreme Court, we know for sure.
Well, it sounds like another show. Pencil on your calendar when it comes down the next day.
I look forward to it.
And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. You can also remember our show and website phonetically. It's Easy Bytes, is what it sounds like, of ESI information. However you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes, learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shineman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Juranov, wishing you a nice day.